Hi, I'm Dr. Mark Gold. I've been working in this field actively since about 1972 and have worked in amphetamine research, tobacco research, smoking in general, as well as cocaine and opioids. And my most probably important contribution to the opioid use disorder field was early work at Yale and followed up on the neuroanatomy of opioid action, the neuroanatomy of opioid withdrawal, how to treat opioid withdrawal, and how to use medication-assisted treatments in patients and follow them for 5 years, which I think is the outcome standard. Opioids are considered amongst the most reinforcing and most addicting drugs of abuse because they stimulate their own taking and do this in a way that causes continued compulsive use despite numerous adverse consequences. It's this fatal attraction that underlies addiction rather than simply they cause a withdrawal syndrome. The opioid withdrawal syndrome is quite remarkable and easy to see, but easy to treat. And it's part of the issue in that people want to eliminate it. So more opioids and more opioids. Opioids could be taken as a pill, prescription medication, and become addicting. That's very clear. Both physiologically inducing dependence with an abstinence syndrome, but in addition, creating craving, wanting, liking, continued compulsive use despite consequences. A pill can do that just as easily as smoking opium, and while the time frame may be different and the overdose liability may be different as injection of heroin. This is so much the case that people, as the opioid epidemic got going, people changed from prescription opioids, which you had to get from a doctor's office, which were limited in quantity, to heroin, which was cheaper and more widely available on the street. All drugs of abuse stimulate their own taking and are believed to do this by causing dopamine release in the nucleus accumbens. Every drug does about the same thing, some more dramatically than others, but there are host factors involved, and we often ignore them. A person who's exceedingly anxious or perfectionistic might find opioids, when given for pain, cause a great sense of relief and release from anxiety, in addition to stimulating their own taking and having an anti-pain response. Opioids also acutely produce euphoria. For a person who's dysphoric or anhedonic or depressed, that again is an extra reason that opioids might be very compelling, very addicting. So you have a complex of factors. You have the dose, the duration, the route of administration, the host factors, all conspiring to make opioids like cocaine amongst the most addicting drugs of abuse. Opioids stimulate their own taking. Opioids interact with the brain's reinforcement pleasure centers, and in doing that cause euphoria. Over time, opioids change the brain, make euphoria more of a memory and less realistic, and people are using opioids just to break even, but actually are more and more depressed over time. Opioid addicts are anything but euphoric, have continued compulsive use despite numerous adverse consequences, from infectious disease to cardiovascular disease to accidents to depression. That depression is very, very difficult to treat. Both pre-existing depression and after opioid depression are compromised function, and the person may feel compelled to continue use of opioids even though it's not really an antidepressant and it's also not really relieving their angst about having two diseases. Their opioid addiction as well as their depressive disorder. When we see people in a pain clinic, we ask them a variety of questions and give them instruments to give us an idea about whether they're misusing their prescriptions or taking them as prescribed and so on. But now in the midst of an opioid crisis, it's pretty clear that while there are individual differences and some people might be addicted very quickly and have an opioid use disorder early on in response to prescription opioids, and other people might take weeks to months for that to manifest, almost everyone, when given unlimited access to opioids, develop changes that make continued use more likely. Pre-existing depression, pre-existing psychiatric disease are both host factors that make addiction more likely. Being a child of a drug-addicted person makes addiction more likely. Being exposed in utero or in early life, as we saw in our studies of opium smoking in Afghanistan, make addiction more likely. Use of other drugs of abuse and cigarette smoking make addiction more likely to opioids because the brain is primed. All drugs of abuse have the same net effect on the brain, whether they're alcohol, nicotine, cocaine, or heroin. While the magnitude of the effect may differ, and while the time to the brain may differ because of the route, they all have the same net effect, and that priming or teaching or bad learning makes addiction more likely. Self-detox is something that you hear from patients in the street, that they'll take bootlegged medications or over-the-counter medications, quote, to relieve withdrawal distress. Some people may drink alcohol to excess to relieve withdrawal distress. In almost all cases that I've seen over the last 45 years, this is just an interim measure, and they go back to their use and are at high risk for overdose and relapse. Clinicians need to understand that supplements or street detox are not a replacement for an opioid use disorder treatment program, whether residential or in the VA or in an outpatient setting. Provision of evaluation services, intervention, and opioid use disorder treatment services, psychosocial treatments, and medication-assisted therapies are far, far superior to anything that's available on the street. Early on in the opioid crisis, physicians were the principal source of opioids that were used and abused. These came from overprescribing. These came from people retaining their opioid prescriptions in their medicine cabinets and homes in the event that they might have a pain syndrome, or came from people shopping, if you would, in their grandparents' or parents' medicine cabinets. Medications find a home, and they find an abuse pattern, which they did. And so early on, the principal medications were pharmaceutical medications. Quickly, that became too expensive, too inconvenient with office hours and making an appointment, and restricted by various laws. And most of the prescription opioid users switched to street heroin, which often includes adulterants, other medications, fillers, and now fentanyls. Reducing prescriptions reduces simply the amount of prescription opioids available to patients who needed them, and then through diversion to people who were taking prescription medications. Now, more and more, we have heroin and then synthetics. And we expect, the experts expect, synthetics to take over. Just restricting the total amount of opioids prescribed can't possibly be a strategy that would be effective in a nation like ours with polysubstance abuse, drug abuse in childhood and adolescence to prime the brain, and with a culture that has widely available and accessible multiple drugs of abuse just on almost every street corner. The fact of the matter is, even if you look at the autopsy results reported by CDC and investigators like Bruce Goldberger, you find that the opioid use disorder deaths include cocaine, include having other drugs present at the time, like benzodiazepines and cannabis, and is really more of a polydrug problem. The 2 million or so people with substance use disorders need intervention and treatment, and that would be really very effective in reducing the problem that we have today, much more so than simply reducing the prescribing. If you look at all of the different interventions that might help us with the opioid crisis, and the Allison Pitt study says, well, gee, you know, if we don't do anything, we'll lose another large number of people, maybe 500,000 people, based on the Stanford model. If we reduce the impact of the opioid crisis and reduce death, to start with naloxone availability, add MAT intervention psychosocial treatment, add rehab, and actually down the line, we have medical education and prevention of from the provider side. I was a commission member of the CASA work group that studied for many years the addiction medicine crisis and what do we need as a society to make a difference. And there were a number of things we identified, but at the top of the list was educating physicians. Physicians find addicted people to be very difficult. They're difficult in comparison to other patients. And they'll tell you stories like, when I gave somebody Narcan, they were angry or mad. They weren't thankful. When I gave them CPR or a Heimlich maneuver or cardioversion, they said I saved their life. So the lack of initial gratitude is one thing. The demanding nature of the patients. The patients are de facto, oftentimes, experts on opioid drugs and can be, when they're prescription seeking and doctor shopping, very difficult. They also, even in the best medication-assisted treatments, don't show for appointments sometimes. So they can be disrupting a doctor's patient flow and practice, again making it difficult. So in the same for the CASA report showed that training the physician manpower is difficult but absolutely essential. And that starts with early education of physicians in medical school and maybe giving them an actual clerkship like they have in OB or like they have in surgery, where they physically have to go and do evaluations, do interventions, do treatment on an addiction medicine detox or treatment program service. Pharmacists have a critical role in patient education, and when a pharmacist gives a prescription, they'll oftentimes ask a person about the prescription, if they understand the side effects, if they understand the various addiction liability that might come with that, and the drug-drug interactions that are so common and important, like with benzodiazepines, or the admonition, like don't drink or don't mix the prescription with alcohol. Pharmacists also do this in inpatient services and medical oncology practices and play a critical role in patient education and prevention.